ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, it's Lisa Leong from This Working Life, helping to make your work life better with advice from the world's top experts, like psychotherapist Esther Perel.
Many conflicts are about power. Power is when I dismiss what you're bringing up. Power is when I magnify a problem.
And Professor Adam Grant.
We need to take our critics and our cheerleaders and turn them into coaches.
Free coaching! Search for This Working Life on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm David Marr. When David Malouf died last Wednesday, so many of us, so many of you, lost a companion who's been around most of our lives. Since Bicycle, the first collection of poetry in 1970, and Jono, the first novel in 1975. And there he was through all the books since, essays, poetry, novels. He lived to engage readers everywhere. So polite. He never raised his voice. He knew who he was, but asked for no favours. Reciting lists of his prizes bored him, though I think he might have taken secret pleasure from being declared on the occasion of Queensland's 150th anniversary one of the icons of the state, along with the Bee Gees, Gladys Moncrief and the Great Barrier Reef. A little kid who lived in the dark under the floorboards of a Queenslander in South Brisbane before the war, he was introduced to the Iliad by his teacher at the age of 9. I immediately imagined it all taking place, he told ABC's Late Line. I saw Hector's body being dragged in the school playground, you know, with its gravel. Homer and the gods were with him all his life. For a decade, he retreated to England, but returned home in the late 1960s and the writing began. What I think I'm doing, he told the Irish novelist Colm Tóibín a few years ago, is going to an ordinary or familiar situation and in some really attentive way, looking at it again and trying to discover a strangeness or mystery there that at first glance you wouldn't see. Rather than following a theme, what I do, I think, is try to explore the mystery of that strangeness. As job descriptions go, I would call that boundless. To discuss the man and his work, I'm joined by that fine novelist, Kate Grenville, the wonderful poet, Peter Goldsworthy, and David's good friend, the novelist, Nicholas Jose. Welcome to you all.
Lovely to be here with you, David. Thanks.
First encounters of the work and the man, Peter.
I was 17, fresh arrived down to board in Adelaide as a medical student, and Bicycle and Other Poems, which cost $1, which was about the price of little lovely poetry books. Then the whole Penguin Modern European Poetry was like 80 cents. And I sacrificed my lunch money, which I'd hard earned over the Christmas break, for a cheese roll at the Buttery, and bought Bicycle and loved it. So that was, and this was the first book of poems that UQP ever published. To whom we owned so much in terms of poetry publishing in this country.
Were you already writing poetry?
Yes, but it was sort of it was the opposite, I think, of Malouf. It was sort of political poetry, and, you know, anti-Vietnam sort of stuff, and Ginsberg, you know, was probably one of the models with his, well, I won't quote his most famous line that we used to chant.
had
to do with America doing something nasty with an atom bomb to itself.
Yes, yes, yes. Peter, when did you first meet the man?
Oh, years and years and years later. At Writers' Week, yes, and probably after my own first books came out.
Nicholas, your first encounter with the writing and the man, and how did he strike you?
I was living in the UK at the time. I was doing postgraduate study, and my sister sent me the paperback of Jono in 1976 when it came out in Penguin, And I was sort of wondering what to do with my life, thinking about Australia. It was not long after the dismissal of the Whitlam government, so things in Australia were pretty turbulent, and I was wondering if it was a good idea to go there. I read Jono and I was just blown away, because here was something new in Australian writing. It was fresh, it was clear, it was luminous, and it also seemed to promise a sort of new Australia. And so that really was important for me, that book. I was starting to write, I was reviewing for the Times Literary Supplement, etc. And here was something really great from Australia. So I followed David's work after that. I think when An Imaginary Life came out a couple of years later, I reviewed it. I met him, and I met him actually by visiting him at his house in Tuscany in the early 1980s. And he then let me borrow that house for an extended period of writing for myself. So I wrote my novel, Paper Nautilus, there basically, and we've, you know, David and I have been good friends ever since.
And your impression of the man, did you find him deeply contradictory?
Yes, paradoxical, unpredictable in some ways. I mean, he was very private, but he was also very sociable and public. He was very disciplined about his writing always, and that was a powerful message sort of wasted on me probably, but important to observe. He never liked the official side of things very much, and he was always much happier when he would go behind the scenes and could laugh about things. So there was that very sort of good-humoured and, you know, sort of seeing and satirical side of him. But on the other hand, he felt that the, you know, the matter of Australia was important, and so that those official things, whether on the Australia Council or being on endless other committees, getting awards,
the Board of the Opera,
all of that stuff was also a role that he, very unusually really, as a writer, could be given and could a role he could play constructively.
But he did always see himself as a public figure, didn't he? I don't mean that he was putting on airs and graces at all, but that as a writer he had a responsibility to the Australian world of writing.
Yes, but also in some ways as an outsider. I mean, this is part of the paradox. What you were saying at the beginning, David, about how he felt he could bring something new or, you know, explore that mystery, it was partly through being able to see it differently. I mean, I think a huge part of that is that he was from Brisbane, and he was a sort of Queensland exceptionalist. You know, and so he didn't have a monolithic idea of Australia at all. In fact, one of the things he liked about Australia was that every state was different and people used different words and had different accents and all of that. And that in the case of Brisbane, things were often done differently there, you know, starting with the schooling and the religious, the denominational arrangements for schooling and the English curriculum, all of that was sort of different in Queensland. And so that gave him a bit, you know, a very interesting take on things. One of my images I have, which not something I saw, but something I was told, that when he was writing Jono in Sydney in the early 70s, it was in the upper room of a house in Woolloomooloo or Darlinghurst, and he would be just there in the window late at night. There was no blind, he was sort of visible, but into the small hours, you know, writing Jono, which is, after all, a book really about Brisbane. So there's always that slight, slightly strange perspective, you know, that angle to the universe, which isn't straight on with David.
Kate Grenville, your first meeting of his work and of him.
Look, the first time I met him, well, you couldn't really say meet him. He was one of my lecturers at Sydney University when I was doing my undergraduate years. And I realise now that he must have only just started lecturing when he was one of my lecturers.
He got back in about 68. When were you there?
That's right. I think I started in 69. So what struck me at the time, you know, I had had such high hopes of university. I'd loved literature at school. And I'd done well, and I'd written a few pathetic little things and sent them out and got rejection letters. So I thought studying English would be exactly what would be right for someone who longed to be a writer. But when I got there, of course, it was all different, very discouraging. I remember one of my tutors said to me, "What do you want to do?" And I said, oh, rather shyly, I said, "Look, I'd like to be a writer." And he was a man who smoked a pipe. And it was very clear as he let out a plume of smoke that he was actually laughing at the idea of me being a writer.
I think, Kate, I know that man, but
oh,
go on.
Oh, dear.
Yes.
I probably shouldn't have.
No, perhaps. No, absolutely. It was so dry. Oh, God, it was dry. But David was not dry.
No. Look, as a lecturer, he was amazing because most of the lecturers had a kind of, as you say, dry and slightly, there was always a slightly ironic tinge to their lecturing and a sense of almost cynicism. And very much they were up there as the ones who knew and we were down there scribbling our notes. There was an assumption that we were not particularly interested, which I found kind of offensive. There was a sense that we were a bit of a nuisance, actually. Look, this morning I was thinking about all this and I thought to myself, I've never been able to admit to myself how unhappy I was at university and what a devastating experience it actually was for me. But to get back to the positive, David was a kind of ray of light in two ways. First of all, his lecturing style was so, look, I can only say it was like innocent enthusiasm. There was an eagerness. There was an assumption that we were as interested as he was. There was an assumption that he was talking to equals, although that's obviously bizarre. So the whole experience, you came out of one of his lectures feeling sort of exhilarated in a quiet, calm way. He was never a show-off, unlike some of the others. Oh, gosh, I have a lot of animus hidden away about all this, don't I?
Yes, it's boiling up, Kate.
So what David said was, it's okay. There are other people out here who love writing and books and ideas as much as you do and who don't need to reduce it to a set of sort of academic beliefs. The other astonishing thing, of course, is that I think his book of poetry came out in 1970, Bicycle, if I'm right.
Yes, in any 1970, case, $1. I've got it in my hand.
That's right, yes.
Peter's correct. It says one paperback poets, $1.
Wow, those were the days.
Mine's here too, David.
When I discovered that this man who was the bright spark in the lecturers, that he was also actually a poet, a creator, not just someone who was pouring over the works of literature of the past and kind of deadening them in a way. Here was someone who was actually doing it. It was possible to think about literature and also be a powerful creative voice. I remember reading the poetry and thinking about the mild man who I'd seen, you know, up on the platform.
Yes.
And thinking, this is fantastic. First of all, yes, there is more than what I'm getting from these other lecturers. And also, there is hope for you too. In spite of the man with the pipe, the most surprising people can become writers, and you never know, it might happen to you too.
Did you also get that sense, which I get very strongly from his work, that wherever we are, the universe is with us and the past is with us? You know, you can be in a boring lecture theatre in Sydney University, but around you is the whole world.
Yes, absolutely. And what a gift that is. You know, one of the things about the time when he was lecturing and I was an undergraduate was that it was the time of Leavis, where you were not allowed to even acknowledge that a piece of writing had an author, let alone, you know anything about them. That was kind of, it was not just verboten, it was kind of gauche. It was almost like, you know, asking them to, you know, pull their pants down. It was, there was something kind of terrible about wanting to know the biography of a writer, which is the other reason why having an actual writer standing up on the platform talking about whatever he was talking about was so extraordinary. But that sense of the whole world being within us all and all around us all the time. One of the lectures that I remember, because I found my notes about it the other day in the back of my book of Shakespeare, was Hamlet. And I think I'd studied it at school, but it was a revelation, and it felt suddenly personal. Hamlet was suddenly not just a series of, you know, exercises in literature or meaning. It was a personal thing of another confused young person struggling with the world. What a gift that was to me. He kind of rescued those years for me. Thank you, David.
That's David Malouf who's being thanked there. On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. We're celebrating the life of David Malouf, and I'm joined by Kate Grenville, who you've just heard, Nicholas Jose, and Peter Goldsworthy. The gods. I'm very interested in this, that I don't get any sense from David Malouf's work that he was remotely interested in Christianity. I think he was a pagan, wasn't he?
I think he was truly a pagan in the best sense of the word.
I'm only using the word as praise.
And that was truly liberating for him.
Well, I think the Greek gods took over his mind for an early, and then the Latin poets too, from that, you're talking about that early experience with the
gods were in the Brisbane Hills, weren't they?
Well, they're even in a bicycle in that early, the title poem of Bicycle and other poems, of course, the bicycle is light-limbed Hermes, you know, it's the messenger gods, and so it's buried there already in that poem.
Yes, but Peter, isn't the absence of Christianity so interesting? It's there's none of that there.
Well, Nicholas would know more, but one of the interesting things that I was thinking, it's a bit, he had a mother who was a Sephardic Jew and a father who was, well, Australian, but originally a Maronite Arab Christian. That's like Montagues and Capulets, but I don't know where that leads you religiously.
I think he was actually very impatient with religion.
Yes.
Generally. He told me once that how he would get to sleep when he couldn't sleep was by reciting to himself the opening lines of Paradise Lost. And by line 10, he was gone. You
know? In a deep slumber.
But I think he was irritated by religion, but it also did disturb him. So it's not absent in that sense. And I think he didn't like the sort of excesses of religious sort of manifestations, you know, people weeping and howling and carrying on. He saw that as sort of dangerous, I think, because it was so off-putting to the people on the other side. And so, you know, religion became, as it still is, a source of war and destruction.
Nicholas, how could you say that?
The fact that we're in it more than ever, you know, two millennia on, is just kind of breathtaking.
Peter, Nicholas mentioned that, you know, his father was Lebanese. His mother was, a Sephardic Jew from England. So there were these three currents in his house. There was the English, the Jewish, and the Christian, and the Lebanese. But Peter, he wasn't interested in being any of those things.
No, well, that's the essence of being a pagan, I guess. And he certainly doesn't believe, as those, it's very interesting to see as the poetry gets darker, you know, from maybe his eighth decade on or seventh decade on, he knows it's all going to end. There's no sense of the soul escaping. But Nicholas and I distinguish a pool, David, because I think I mentioned the Montagues and the Capulets and his children. But Nicholas, there's something was Nicholas can probably shed light on, I might be wrong, that his grandfather kind of semi-excommunicated his father for going to the into the Catholic Church instead of the Maronite
Yes, church. There was that. But isn't the thing that united the father's family and the mother's family that they both came from the world of boxing?
Yes, exactly. And David's one of David's ancestors on the mother's side was Daniel Mendoza, this famous Jewish boxer in 19th century England, which sort of linked him to then his own father, who, you know, I think was a sort of an accommodator of these differences.
Yes.
So there's a very moving moment in one of David's essays in 12 Edmondson Street of himself as a small child, and there's a room of old men who's his grandfather and others speaking in Arabic, you know, in the back room in Brisbane, and he as a child could not understand what they were saying but could only marvel, you know, the fact that they were sort of speaking this other language and sharing stories and laughter.
Mm. And Peter, you tell the story of him being amazed at a literary festival in Canada to be described as Australian Lebanese.
Yes, actually, we were on stage together talking about some Australian identity, I don't know, some nonsensical subject. But and he was introduced as the Lebanese-Australian writer David Malouf. And he said it's the first time he'd been hyphenated like that. He'd always thought of himself as an Australian and a writer. And he thought the Canadians were the pioneers of what later became ubiquitous hyphens. And that was quite amusing, actually, I thought.
I think another strand from his childhood, you know, maybe a fourth strand that was really important, was that he grew up in Brisbane during the war of age during the war. Brisbane, you know, the Brisbane line, I mean, Brisbane was really on the edge of, you know, whatever might come. But the Americans were in town. You know, Brisbane was an American base. Brisbane was sort of segregated, and the black American servicemen were kept on the other side of the river where there were jazz clubs and there was nightlife and, you know, there was sort of what became rock and roll. And
there was Donald Friend.
Donald Friend
cruising around the south side.
Absolutely.
In the black regions. But yeah. That's
sort of the
another writer for another time.
The carnival-esque darkness that David...
God, it must have been fabulous.
..felt. I can't work out exactly how old he was. He must have been...
Well, he was only about 10 when the war started.
When it started, but when it finished, he was 15, I guess that means. So that's a pretty formative stage of life, to have this whole other world. And was that pagan? In a way, it might have been for him.
But he also spoke wonderfully about being a little boy and being told stories of the First World War. And there was a sense that his whole childhood and early manhood was overshadowed by war.
Yes. And the book that he wrote out of that, Fly Away Peter, about the boy from what is now Surfers Paradise going to France in the First World War, is probably one of the most widely read of all Australian books. It's been set for school study for years. I don't know if it still is now.
It still is, actually.
It's short, it's beautiful, and it's eloquent. And it does speak to, you know, Australian myth as well.
It's a long poem in many ways, I think. It's very lyrical.
You know, in the sense of the Anzac story sort of lies behind it.
I have a story about that. Many, many years ago,
Peter
had the idea, or my wife had the idea of turning it into, who taught it many times, of turning it into an opera. And so I approached David and he said yes. And then a couple of years passed, I didn't, until myself and Richard Mills were able to maybe get some money for that from Opera Australia. And then I rang him and said, oh, oops, I've just given it to someone else. So that was that.
You cannot delay.
Yeah.
Kate, you were one of many who David then, having been your teacher, then discovered and helped. What did he do?
Look, I met him, I think, probably for the first time on the publicity trail for Lillian's Story, which was my first novel. And he was... I'm finding it hard to put into words the notion of you saw David, his face would light up with that fabulous smile of his. He would say, come and let's have a cup of coffee. And he'd sit down, and it was very clear that whatever else had been going on beforehand, at the forefront of his mind, an idea had been bubbling away, something he didn't quite understand, something about politics or life or history or some thing that he was chewing away at. And he would sit down and he'd be fizzing with energy about that. And never in a... You know, the wonderful thing about David Malouf is that he never once mansplained, or not to me anyway. He never harangued. It was always out of his incredible generosity would come bubbling these ideas, and he would be genuinely interested in what you felt about it. I would come away feeling way out of my depth, needless to say, but also incredibly excited and stimulated by the fact that there was a great depth out there that I could paddle in. Better to paddle in the depths, after all, than to be subsumed by the shallows. So I kept, over the years, I would meet him many times in that kind of context. But it kind of been too much later than that, actually, that he invited me to dinner. And clearly what had happened was that Patrick White must have asked to meet me. And Patrick White, a good friend of mine, was a woman who worked in the bookshop where he bought most of his books. Barbara was just a shop assistant, but she was an extraordinary older woman of such warmth and modest generosity.
And he loved her.
He loved her. Barbara must have said to him one day, you've got to read this book, Lillian's Story, by a young woman that I know. And he read it and wrote to me out of the blue, a dazzling fiction of universal appeal. He wrote... Unsolicited, he wrote that to UQP, and for many years it was on the cover. Anyway, he must have been curious about the woman who wrote this slightly peculiar book, and I think David might have been asked to set up a dinner. So I was, needless to say, a nervous wreck at the idea of meeting Patrick White. But what I remember about that night is David Malouf's incredible generosity. He could see that I was overawed. He probably also saw that Patrick was kind of like come to a bit of a dead end with me. And in the most wonderful, urbane, unnoticeable way, he just made the whole thing flow with fabulous warmth and generosity so that I really did feel part of it where I might not have. I remember it as a glimpse into a literary Sydney that I've never been part of, which was these, what I thought of as the grown-ups in the room, gossiping madly and quite maliciously, very amusingly, about somebody whose name I either didn't catch or hadn't heard of, so I couldn't remember. But I was astonished that these huge names in Australian literature could sit around the dinner table being as bitchy, basically, as anybody else. It was, it was a revelation.
A moment of growth, Kate. A moment
writers
of growth.
Are not sacred objects. Absolutely.
Now, look, here is the memory of Omar Saker, who was also helped by David Malouf.
It's around 2018 now, and I'm in my auntie's housing commission home in Casula, where I grew up and where I was once again living, because I had no place of my own. But I had a debut poetry collection and David Malouf's phone number. And I called him from there and I asked if I could send him my new manuscript and if he would read it. He graciously agreed, and we met some weeks later, had a coffee at Broadway. He told me he read it through 3 times. He had nothing but praise for it, and ended up providing an endorsement for the book. He showed me around his home in Glebe, which he was in the final stages of packing up, having sold it. He moved to the Gold Coast after that, and I lost that golden landline connection, but we stayed in touch. When he published his last poetry collection, an open book, we met several times. Coincidentally, at writers' festivals. And whenever we did, we'd eat together and chat. And not once did he ever put on airs. Not once was there a suggestion that this man had the appellation National Living Treasure to his name, or that he had better things to do than talk to this young, poor, emerging Arab Australian poet. He was unfailingly generous with his time, humble in his manner, precise in his language, and on more than one occasion happily nominated me for major fellowships and things of that nature. This is to say, he continued to support me throughout the years. One of the highlights of my life is the night we did an event together in Newcastle, and we shared a mic, his poems and my poems. But you know what sticks in my mind the most is not the stage, not awards, not prestige of any kind. It's the food we ate and the arguments we had about identity politics and poetry, literature and life. He grew up in a time of the White Australia policy and famously did not refer to himself as Arab or Lebanese. "Call yourself what you want, David," I said to him more than once. "You still look like my Juddo, my grandfather." And he would laugh, and I could tell that pleased him. And he'd say something like, "Okay, yes, sure, but really, Omar, there are only two types of people in the world, the healthy and the sick." He was the first Arab Australian author in this country, and his legacy is enormous. If I can be for someone else even half of what he was to me, I will leave this earth happy. Goodbye, Habibi.
Omar Saker. This is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and we're celebrating the life and the writing of David Malouf with Kate Grenville, Nicholas Jose, and Peter Goldsworthy.
I'm just thinking of the generosity that people have been talking about. And just briefly, the first time I did meet David was after An Imaginary Life had come out, and it was in Adelaide, Writers Festival, and he didn't know me from a bar of soap, but I loved that book. The Ovid book, and I followed him out of an event and caught up with him and just said how much I liked it. He sat down on a bench there with me, and we spoke for half an hour. This is just time he gave to this fan. I'm just thinking that there was no call to give me that much time at all. Yeah.
It was lovely to hear Kate, to hear you talking about that dinner with David and Patrick, because I think David definitely loved to have the gossip. but I can we ask you, David Marr, to say something about David Malouf and Patrick White, which I might just preface with the anecdote that David always told himself about being castigated by Patrick. I think it must have been at the opening of the opera Voss.
Oh, yes.
Again in Adelaide. And they played the national anthem while the governor or whoever came in. And Patrick had sat down for the national anthem and got to David afterwards and said, "I saw you there standing up. I saw your plump little bottom sort of wiggling."
And it was a falling out between them that lasted for a time. Yes. David Malouf was a stranger to that kind of point scoring, but I got into his bad books. After Patrick White died, some years after, his papers became available, and we discovered in there the first draft of the first third of a novel that he never completed. But that first draft is just sublime, and it was published as The Hanging Garden, and David Malouf was furious. He said to me, "What a writer publishes in their lifetime is their opus. They define what they wish to be remembered by, and you have violated that." Wow, he gave me the rounds of the kitchen.
Mm.
And I suspect, therefore, that there are no unpublished novels, there are no great confessions, there are no rich little stories yet to be published from his bottom drawer.
Mm, that's so interesting. I mean, who knows about that? But David did talk a lot about the body of a writer's work, meaning the body of his work. And he believed that every piece you add to it sort of changes the whole thing in small ways or large.
Yes, I remember him telling me that.
He's very preoccupied with, yes, that body of work. And I think he was paying attention to that at the end. I mean, he was preparing his collected poems for publication, which will no doubt come along quite soon. But I believe that we as readers haven't really come to terms with the whole body of his work. And maybe that's something that can happen now. But the literary world is very sort of fractured and compartmentalised. So the poets sort of take an interest in the poets. The novelists are up for the major prizes. The essayists, no one even knows who they are. You know, and it was staggering that one of, for me, David's best pieces of all-time writing is an essay called A First Place, which is where he talks about, you know, the spaces in a Queensland house and being under the house and where that can take you imaginatively.
In the dark.
In the dark. He gave that as a talk at Sydney University in 1984. It was not published in book form for 30 years until 2014 when Knopf brought out the three volumes of David's essays. And even when they came out at the time, I don't remember there being a lot of interest in them. So to pull together those essays, all of the poetry from first to last, the fiction, the libretti, the opera stuff, you know, and to kind of take that all in as a body of work is work, I think, that's yet to happen, and good work.
But
I think, as you say, David was very, yeah, careful, and there probably isn't a lot outside that to be discovered.
But when a great writer dies, Nicholas, we're confronted by the memory of the work we've read and the work we haven't read.
Mm.
Whoever comes to grips with the whole corpus of a writer's life, only surely a handful of scholars will read everything.
Yes, I think it's not so much about reading everything, but reading across the variety to try to understand what it means, and in this case, what it means as an Australian writer, as a writer in Australia, to be dealing with these different things. I mean, I think some of what I'm saying is the difficulty of being, if you like, a transnational writer. I mean, David had different publishers, different editors, different agents in different countries, and different readerships, and that's very difficult to negotiate. I mean, it's a good thing, but it's complicated. I'd be interested to hear what Kate and Peter have to say about this, but thinking of David as part of his generation, and so by that I mean Peter Carey, Helen Garner, Frank Morehouse, you know, just to name a few. They're all they're all pushing against the forms of writing. I mean, they're not writing the sort of conventional whatever it is. They're innovating. And I think that's to do with trying to find a way to express their experience as Australians, but also for a wider audience. And, you know, it's part of David's legacy that he did that. But I think it's, you know, it's not simple.
Kate Grenville, that question to you. I mean, do you think it is necessary to invent or develop new forms in order to write about our lives now?
No, I think it isn't. And I think David's work, and also in a way Patrick White's work, proves that you can use the old vehicles. But I think one of the things, I mean, like Patrick White, he rescued Australian writing from a kind of bland pedestrianness that I seem to remember growing up with, where language was simply a means of getting from A to B. You told a story. In fact, usually you told a rattling good yarn. That was the kind of Australian writing I grew up with. Rather than the language itself being, you know, part of what you were doing. So in a way, I'm wondering whether, this is a bit of a leap into the dark, but I'm wondering whether that sense that we've all talked about of David being in a way between worlds, I mean, his work is often about exile and or belonging, two sides of the same coin. I'm wondering whether the way he used language, which was to elevate it far beyond the pedestrian, far beyond getting from A to B, was a kind of displacement of the, I want to use the word anxiety, of his position of kind of exile, of being in between worlds. So what he offered us was a richness of language, a powerful poetic prose, which I can't remember anybody apart from White having done in Australian writing before. So it didn't look like a new form on the surface. In fact, it could have looked like a return to a very much older form where beauty of language, complication of syntax was a mark of real engagement with the subject. You could almost say that he was a throwback to that. But in the era in which he wrote here in Australia, it was a very foreign thing to be doing and in that sense, revolutionary.
And what you were never taught about at Sydney University in those years is the magic of the prose.
That's right, absolutely. And, you know, just this morning, looking at something online about David, apparently some editor tried to fix up a paragraph of his.
Oh, yes.
And when he protested, I think it was a she, said, oh, I was just saving you from an awkwardness in this paragraph. And he said, and I'm quoting, "All we have are our awkwardnesses." And that seems to me precisely where true creativity and true wisdom is. You don't iron things flat. You don't come to an answer. You don't decide whether it's exile or belonging. You are always in this fabulously, not only fabulously interesting state, but also fabulously true state of being awkward because you are always, always still working things out.
But Nicholas Jose, he was not a confessional writer. We learn from something from his poetry, but not from his prose, really anything about his private emotional life. And I wonder, I mean, you knew him well, and I've always wondered this, was he happy? He wrote about happiness. There's a beautiful essay about how we achieve happiness through self-fulfillment, etc. But was he happy?
I think he felt fortunate, and he felt he'd had a good life, which is something. Reading those early prose works, Jono and An Imaginary Life, I think both of those books, they're written under a spell, and there's a kind of a rapture, really, in both of them. Now, whether that comes out of private circumstances at the time, I have no idea. But I think he doesn't write about his private life in a sort of egotistical way, but I think he's always writing about his private life in other ways, you know, the inner life that is part of the new thing he's doing. And there is a great sense of loss through his work. There's a strong sense of time passing, and there's even a sense sometimes that it might all be, you know, be for nothing, that it will all vanish. But that also speaks to the good times, the happy times, the loving times that there have also been. And just a footnote there, I think family was truly important to him. And by family, I really mean his relationship with his sister Jill. So in that house in Brisbane, there was mother and father, but there was also sister Jill. And they were very, very close. I mean, they would speak on the phone every day. And when she died a few years ago, that was a huge absence for David.
There's a, Nick, there's, hey, David, there's a wonderful line in one of the poems, later poems, where he's sort of, he's not looking forward, that's the word, but he knows he's going to become one of the grateful dead. I mean, I'm going to go ungratefully, I know, but that maybe that's relevant there to what we're saying. You're suggesting about a life really well lived, for all its ups and downs.
Yes, one of the Kate.
So, well, I was just thinking of the last time I met David. He must have invited me to lunch, I think, with some other people, and we ate fish. And he explained that these days he was no longer driving. I don't know whether he ever had, actually, but he was very aware that he was getting older and needed to keep fit. And he told us how it was one of his great pleasures to walk down to the fish market from his Myrtle Street Chippendale house, buy the fish that we had eaten and walk back. And as he told us about this, the buying of the fish, the walking down to the market through a very interesting part of town and back, I thought this is a man whose pleasure can be in the minutiae of life. For him, at the age he was then, which was already quite old, it was kind of enough that the day offered these small but incredibly intense pleasures in the context of the fact that he wouldn't be able to enjoy them forever.
Mm. Do you know, Kate, do you know that wonderful sequence, The Crab Feast, where he's hunting mud crabs, and then it has a lot more than just an ordinary crab feast in it, but it's
and, always... and cooking the crabs, am I right, Peter?
Yes, that's right. Yes, it's full of pleasures like that. But
he loved food.
Sensuousness, generally.
He said the most wonderful thing about the purpose of Italian cooking. Do you remember this line of his, that the purpose of Italian cooking was to make glut palatable? I mean, it's moments like that. You just got to give a standing ovation to the man. I mean, where does that come from? Hey, favourite lines. Kate, have you got, you know, bits of David that roll around in your head?
Look, it's the very famous one from Remembering Babylon. The man says, you know, white man's been living with the Aboriginal people for many years, and is just trying to reintroduce himself into British colonial society. He stands on a fence and says, "Don't shoot. I am a British object." To use that simple language in that way, it's just wonderful.
But that's not David's invention.
Oh, isn't it?
No, that's true. It's true. That is how that man, returning from a life with the Aborigines, declared himself to the farmhouse.
Oh.
I am a British object.
That's even more fantastic then, that David was able to see. I mean, I've always thought that about his work. The other kind of displacement, he didn't write about his own personal life, I don't think, but as a displacement, he could find a way of talking about that in other stories. And how wonderful that he was actually able to sort of shamelessly know that that had to be part of his story, to actually quote it.
Nicholas Jose, are there lines of David's that keep coming to mind?
Well, one of the poems of his I really like is from that first book, Bicycle and Other Poems. It's called Sheer Edge. And David really liked it too, because he kept reprinting it over and over, and even in his last sort of selected poems, it's there at the front. And it begins here at the sheer edge of a continent. And so I think of him living in that tower on the beach at Surfers Paradise, very much at the sheer edge of a continent. And it goes
Nicholas,
on.
Nicholas, read it. Read it. Come on.
The whole poem?
Yes, it's wonderful.
Here at the sheer edge of a continent, dry weed clutches. Grey gulls turn from the sea and gather here, precariously building their nest. And here too, at the edge of darkness, where all floors sink to abyss, the lighted bar is of light, the furthest promontory, and exit sheer fall. Though words slide off, hands catching fail to hold, here also may flower, precarious as weed or grey gull's nest, the moment of touching the poem.
And Peter Goldsworthy, poet, what has the poet Maloof meant to you?
Well, a lot from that first book, but then the last two books, particularly Earth Hour, I think, when, and I've been rereading it against the last few years since I got sick myself, there's the sense of mortality, the darkness even in a beautiful garden, and gardens, maybe from Horace, I always think, suspect he kind of, I don't know, Nicholas would know better, that he took the Tuscan house. It's a kind of emulation of Horace, who went into the Sabine Hills and wrote beautifully. One of his patrons gave him an enormous estate, Horace. But anyway, there are lots of wonderful lines along that line. I suppose you'd say they're dark, but they're playfully dark. He's always playfully dark in these when he's
even not defeated by the dark.
Definitely not. And this, I mean, that was came out when he was 80. That wonderful book. But there's a series in there, a triptych actually for an elegy for a friend, Joan Tessai, and it's called Towards Midnight. The first one, he takes a cup of espresso, and finds. In that dark, uses that the darkness of in there as the extended metaphor driving the poem, and it's quite a, and it ends in a kind of a typically David tightrope walking, you know, balancing act. I think
yes,
and which is so typical of whether he was walking the tightrope of that hyphen between you know, Lebanese and Australian or whatever. There's always a tightrope. It's a tightrope dancer.
Peter, so, you have the poem.
Okay, Towards Midnight, the cup.
The cup.
In the one cup, darkness, espresso black, night, its distances, its brief proximities, and the arraignment of sunlight on a sill. I drink at the open window heady mouthfuls of breath as the body, guardian angel of the ordinary and of this world, reassembles what sleep for a time has scattered, all the parts and occasions of a singular story on the instant recalled as if new given. An intimation of the eternal return, or bittersweet in the same cup, this draught of absolute dark that shadow-like we carry in us, sometimes lightly, sometimes not.
And that's just a cup of coffee.
Yes, exactly.
Hey, before we go, we must somehow celebrate his wonderful face. That was, Kate, wasn't that just an extraordinary face? And as he grew older, it became more dramatic and more expressive and more completely his own.
Yes, he did it all with his eyes, I think. His face didn't much move, but his eyes said it all. Some tiny set of muscles around his eyes. Understated, like everything he did. Mm-hmm. And always warmly, totally engaged with whoever he was talking to.
Where should someone who has never read a word of David Maloof begin?
Oh, look, probably Jono, I have to say. That knocked me out when I was young.
Okay. Nicholas?
I'd say 12 Edmondson Street.
Peter?
Oh, An Imaginary Life, maybe. Well, look, maybe Ransom.
And Ransom.
Sorry, I'm still sticking good to the classics. But
that covers the
I'm reading it again because my eldest grandson's studying it.
Yes.
And and I'm loving it far more than I did when I first read it when it came out.
Kate Grenville, Nicholas Jose, and Peter Goldsworthy, thanks for joining us to celebrate the life and the work of this man, David Maloof. And would the person who has my copy of Ransom please return it to me? That's the week. My thanks, as always, to the remarkable Late Night Live team, Anne Arnold, Catherine Zengerer, Ali Benton, and our leader, Jack Schmidt. Until next time.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.